When I was 20 years old, I was a student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And it was there that I was introduced to many authors that I would soon realize were actually not authors, but oracles. Oracles who would really help me as a young Black woman tap into sacred energy that's ancestral, sacred energy that's healing, sacred energy that's creative energy. I took a class that was taught by Saweenie Madison that was a performance studies class, but was really magic. And in that class, she introduced me again to Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Gloria Naylor, Gwendolyn Brooks. She carved pathways for me to meet Octavia Butler, Alexis Pauline Gums, Adrienne Marie Brown, and Jackie Shelton Green. Every time I've been in space with Jackie Shelton Green, she has dropped blessings into my lap like ripe mangoes. And I don't even know what I did to be blessed with her as a friend and a mentor, but I'm so glad I did it. There are spaces that we hold together where she calls forth specters that resembles my own shadow. And she reminds me that I have no choice but to knit myself back together with the medicine that's never left me. It really sits inside of my body and is waiting for release. It's critical. It illuminates. We have to remember that. Jackie is an oracle who lives in spaces, pulls out truths, interwines narratives, and provides poetry for this life. I feel very blessed to have her in my life, reminding me that that poetry and that creativity and those words heal me and heal my soul. They break those generational curses. They remind me that my ancestral through line is safe and intact. Give thanks for the oracle. My name is Omi Sade Bernie Scott, and this is the Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause, introducing North Carolina Poet Laureate Jackie Shelton Green. So, Mama Jackie.
Yes, Omi Sade.
Thank you for agreeing to, one, do this interview again. So, there are some folk who were waiting with bated breath for our first interview. Like, I had put it out. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be the best conversation ever. It was the best conversation ever. And I feel like the universe and the ancestors were like, that was just for y'all.
Yeah, I think the ancestors intervened on that one. Mm-hmm. And said, okay, now what is the public version?
I think that's right.
To protect the innocent.
I think that's right. So we are here for round two of the Jackie Omi Show. Mm-hmm. And I want to kick us off with this question, because we were literally just talking about a person we have in common, Dr. Lee Green, who was one of my professors at UNC Chapel Hill when I was a student in the 80s. But this is about oracles. So here's the question. Mm-hmm. Though Lee Green introduced me to Mama Toni Morrison through Blue Is Eye, it was Saweenie Madison who pulled me through a portal. And so when I think about the oracles who were introduced to me when I was like 19, 20, 21 years old, Toni Morrison, Gloria Naylor, Alice Walker, reintroduced to Gwendolyn Brooks in a different way. Mm-hmm. We read Maud Martha. I had never heard of Maud Martha before in my entire life. Mary West.
Wow, that's
all these
that's
women.
That's when you don't hear. Yeah.
Yeah, all these women. Mm-hmm. And I think about where I'm sitting right now, next to who I consider a personification of an oracle. I wonder, who were the oracles that you were introduced to when you were a young woman that let you know that you too were going to walk that path?
Perhaps the most prolific person was Audre Lorde.
Mm-hmm.
Alice Walker, Sonia Sanchez. These are the women when I was very, very young I was reading. Nikki Giovanni.
Mm-hmm.
All these people I would meet when I was very, very young and was in just total awe of them.
Mm-hmm.
But they had already stretched the portal,
mm-hmm.
if I can use that metaphor. They had already stretched that portal and actually validated for so many women of my generation that we were worthy to step inside of that space.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what was happening when I was reading African-American literature, but specifically African-American women, is I didn't really have a frame of reference for it in the context of my everyday life. And these writers just put a mirror up to my everyday life and showed me that I was living the stories they were writing. Mm-hmm. And for every character in A Beloved or Bluest Eye, or in the instance of Zora Neale Hurston, I knew those characters. Mm-hmm. And some of those characters were women around me, women in my family. I remember reading Gloria Naylor's, what was that?
Mama Day.
And Mama Day, mm-hmm. I felt like someone had laced me up in a straitjacket. That was the effect that Mama Day had on me, and Temple of My Familiar.
Yes, yes.
And I remember my cousin, who's a librarian, she was calling me. She said, I know you love this book because it don't make no sense to me. What the hell all these blank pages? I was like, but that's the story.
Right.
And we weren't comfortable with the blank pages. Mm-hmm. And sometimes these people weren't writers. They were just women in my life who I knew, mm-hmm. who knew the stories of those who'd walk before them, like my grandmother, and understood the value of continuing to tell and tell and mm-hmm. tell and tell, and to tell me that's your job. Mm-hmm. Your job is to do nothing but tell. Mm-hmm. Truth teller. Shapeshifter in your truth telling. Because sometimes you have to shapeshift in order to tell the truth to a multitude of people.
Right.
You know, you mm-hmm. can't always be that voice for the people you talked to yesterday. Mm-hmm. You might have to shapeshift to be that same truth for your tomorrow, mm-hmm. Tuesday's audience.
That's right.
And I think part of that comes from growing up in the rural South. Mm. Growing up in the rural South, understanding the codes of silence, the language of silence, things that are lost in translation and silence, because mm-hmm. people are afraid of the silence, and how silence is what governed our lives mm-hmm. during Reconstruction, during the Civil Rights Movement, mm-hmm. and most definitely now. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking a little while ago about the strife of Black people in Durham. Mm-hmm. And I think it is fear. I think it is fear. I think it is the lack of understanding of how you trust. Sometimes we have to be quiet. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we just have to trust that no language is the language. Mm. That sometimes the statement that's required is the absence mm-hmm. of speaking. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that too is a narrative. Mm-hmm. And it's sad to see the internal power plays and the internal, how we've internalized self-hate and unworthiness, how we've allowed a culture to define mm-hmm. certain countenances that should be innate.
Right.
And we've lost them.
I feel like oftentimes people who identify as being women absorb so much of that. Like this fiery, fearful energy gets pulled inside of our bodies. And I really appreciated you reminding us at North Star when you did church and you said to us, we have medicine inside our bodies that is, you said it was dark and thick like blood. And I just, like, I felt like you snatched, I feel like you snatched all the air out of my body when you said that. I was like, oh.
And people reject and run from their own medicine. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much disease because of our dis-ease with living. Mm-hmm. We've forgotten how to be alive. Mm-hmm. We live in a culture that's so socially, culturally, politically toxic. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think women, when I think of women to me, we're like the ground that everybody needs to stand on. Mm. And I didn't say step on. Mm-hmm. That everybody needs to stand on. We hold it up. Mm-hmm. We hold up entire universes. And that's when we talk about you know, self-care is such a buzz now.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to talk about self-care, but we're still not stepping into self-care. Because if we were really stepping into self-care and understanding how to be still, because life is about being and not doing all the time, we would be healthier.
Yeah.
Our medicine would be free. Our medicine would be flowing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even I look at all of the New Age healers now. They're so expensive.
They are.
And healers, true healers don't charge money.
Mm-hmm.
They accept gifts.
Right. It's an energetic exchange.
Energetic exchange. It's a bartering process sometimes.
Yeah.
I was talking to a sister the other day, and she had this amazing painter. I'm not going to mention the famous artist. I mean, this is like multi-million-dollar
mm-hmm.
painting right now. And I was like, is that real?
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, yeah. And I just, she said, it's a long story and a long process of doing work with this person and bartering.
Mm.
And bartering. So we've forgotten that we are a people of a multitude of currencies.
Yes.
We have so much currency.
Yes.
That we don't use. And when we do use it, we tend to bankrupt ourselves. Spiritually, emotionally, even physically. When I look at what we're holding in our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, how we're burying our children.
Mm-hmm.
We're burying our communities.
Mm-hmm.
The medicine is getting buried, too.
Yeah. There was a post I read last week. There are folk who have been exploring marine mammals
mm-hmm.
and what we can learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a post last week. It was either Alexis or Adrienne Marie Brown. I don't remember if it was Alexis Pauline Gums or Adrienne. But they were talking about a particular dolphin
mm-hmm.
that's native to the coast of North Carolina that created a dorsal fin to stabilize itself.
Right.
Like it wasn't something, you know, we talk about the evolutionary destiny of different creatures or species. And if you go back and you look
right.
at the fossils and you say, oh, well, there was evidence that this bump that became a dorsal fin was already there in their
right.
cartilage and that somehow it evolved. Mm-mm. This dolphin shapeshifted
right.
to create stability
and
I think, and survival. And I feel like women, we have the ability to shapeshift, and we often shapeshift.
It's a universe of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But how many of us are really tapping into the natural world? How
mm-hmm.
many of us go to the ocean anymore? How many of us can hear the cry of a sea mammal?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know it's a cry. How many of us have ever communed in the natural world?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we see the natural world teaching us how to survive over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we see insects that are chameleons.
Right.
You know, you go to touch the leaf and something moves because
right.
it is the exact same color. I mean, this summer and last summer, I encountered so many bugs and insects that I had never seen
before
in my life.
And
some of them were kind of weird looking.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I'm like, some of them is like, are you real?
Mm.
Are you some bio-manufactured experiment?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the natural world, going into the wilderness
mm-hmm.
and stripping. Because the wilderness is a place of vulnerability.
Yeah,
it's a place where everything is shedding its skins all the time.
Where are the places that you feel like you've shed your skin? Different points in your
life. It's places where I feel safe to be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
That has not always been with my sisters.
Mm.
That has not always been with male partners or husbands.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been with my children.
Mm.
It's always been with mothers and grandmothers.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? I think I know why with the babies,
yeah.
and we'll talk about that because we both
yeah.
have babies, but I want to know about the mamas and the grandmamas and why you feel like it was okay to shed whatever skins you needed to shed.
And I don't care how old we get.
Yeah.
And like I've watched elders die, and they, you know, their bodies curled into back into a fetal position.
Yeah,
it's like they're going back into a womb.
Yeah,
and I know that when I'm most vulnerable, that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I go into the fetal position,
mm-hmm.
but it's where I'm safe. You know, wombs are wet mm-hmm. and warm
mm-hmm.
and protective.
Yeah, they're strong.
Yeah, so it's more like, what are the wounds I've built around me?
Mm-hmm.
And what have I allowed myself to crawl into them? I'm learning to be more and more vulnerable with women
mm-hmm.
and with all women, because I think that there's just amazing, powerful magic that happens in the company of women,
mm-hmm.
you know, when women gather.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side of that is I used to assume that every sister I met, that we share the same frame of reference and context for certain cultural values mm-hmm. or upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very naive about that. So in doing so, I got injured a lot. I'm sure I injured people because of the assumptions
mm-hmm.
that I just made of, like, you know, like, you look at a sister like, your sister, you feel me. And they're like, no.
You're like, oh.
I'm like, oh.
Okay.
So, it's that nonverbal stuff.
Yeah.
It's that grit you have when you do meet who looks like a stranger. A sister comes into your sphere who's a stranger, but she's really tried.
It's like the first time we met. I remember I walked into the meeting room and I looked at you and I was like, I know this woman.
Yeah.
I was like, I know this woman.
Yeah.
And I said, we've met before, haven't mm-hmm. we? And you said, yes, we have.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall when, but we've met each other before. And during that meeting, there were different moments where in the midst of the conversation, we make eye contact, mm-hmm. and there was all kinds of silent mm-hmm. conversation mm-hmm. going on over the heads of the white folk.
Right.
Where we were having a sister conversation right. over top of the heads of the white folk, like, now you know
mm-hmm.
what he just said mm-hmm. did make mm-hmm. not near a bit of sense.
Right. And I'm with them, but I ain't with them. I'm on the same committee with them, but.
Right.
Those are not my
right. Opinions. I was like, I see you. And right. I felt like you were looking at me like,
yeah, exactly.
I see you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's that, and we've talked about this, tribe recognizes tribe.
That's right.
And I am most happy and most vulnerable when I'm with tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be unguarded, unplugged, totally vulnerable, totally transparent.
Because
mm-hmm. I think that that's how we build true, authentic community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we allow ourselves to be seen by other women at our best and our worst, when we can invite celebration, and when women can hold you up in grief.
Yeah.
You know, there were women who ran from me when Imani was dying.
Mm-hmm.
There were sisters that, because they'd always been in my life, and I called them best friends, and we journeyed to so many different places in our lives, physically and spiritually and emotionally, that I knew they'd be there.
Yeah.
And they were absent. They didn't know how to show up in the grief piece.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to show up in the grief piece. And you just learn that we're not all wired the same way.
No.
And I couldn't judge them because they didn't know how to show up. I knew.
Did they come back around?
Some.
Mm.
And then when I got ill myself,
mm-hmm.
I was definitely ill 2011 until about 2014. I was mm-hmm. in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't walk. I couldn't talk. My brain wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when Duke told me I had about 4 months to live. And I called this sister who I consider in my sisterhood. And I left a message and I said, please call my daughter and my husband. I'm definitely ill. I need to have a conversation with you. I want to see you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dying. I'm not too proud to beg. I want you to come visit me.
Mm-hmm.
That sister never called, never returned that phone call.
Mm-hmm.
to this day, has never acknowledged that I ever
reached out to her. Why do you think that is? What do you think was happening with her when she was looking at you standing at the place where you felt like your mortality was really speaking? What happened?
I don't know. I think people show up differently, uh-huh. embrace this. The fact that I was pretty academic about it, just like, okay, I'm dying. I need you to come see me. My daughter Imani modeled what transition looked like for me. Mm. And a very dignified, yeah. if you can use that word. I don't think any of us really die on our own terms when people say that. But Imani lived up to the minute she died.
That's a beautiful
Up until
thing.
The minute she yeah. lived, there was life mm-hmm. in her.
Mm-hmm.
As she was transitioning, she was still living. Mm-hmm. She was like, yeah, I'm crossing over, but I'm still, I got 1 foot over here. As mm-hmm. long as this 1 foot is over here, I'm going to live it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm halfway over there, but I'm also over here.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see my sisters. I wanted them to come hug me. I wanted them to crawl up in the bed with me and pull me to their bosoms and cry with me.
Yeah.
I wanted them to give me neck massages. I wanted them to hold me.
Yeah.
And it was interesting, people who did show up were like new friendships.
Interesting.
Or people that, women that I had not known that long,
mm-hmm.
who showed up like, I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
What you need?
Mm.
I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. And I'm saying all of this to say, I can't judge. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the lessons that my first husband taught me, I used to think that the way I loved was the way to love. And it took me about 11 years of marriage to this person to one day mature and say, oh, he just doesn't love the way I love, which does not translate into he does not love me. He loves differently.
He loves. That's a huge lesson. Jackie. Yeah.
So it comes back to this question of why the sisters weren't here.
Right.
I never doubted that they loved me. That never, even when a godmother who didn't show up, but who did the morning she died, calling me hysterical from another country, screaming and crying. And I just handed the phone over to another relative. I said, I can't deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
Because my child just died. I am not here to take care of you.
Yeah.
Don't call me screaming. I can't take care of you right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up having to say that to her when she called me a few months later, all hysterical. And I had to say, wait a minute. You did not bury your child. You did not bury your child.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I can't take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
If you need to have these emotional screaming episodes, I need you to call somebody else. And it took a lot for me to say that because I felt like I was pushing that person away. But I was hanging on by a thread emotionally.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that I truly understood what it meant to stand up in your power and take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Because people will strip you bare intentionally or unintentionally.
Yeah.
And think back to Sonia Sanchez's book, Wounded in the Arms of a Friend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you may intentionally put a knife through my heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a knife and it's still going through my heart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So inside of all of that, I really had to become extremely, I don't want to use the word selfish, but extremely, my shields had to go up.
Mm.
My spiritual shields had to cover me, mm-hmm. had to surround me. Mm-hmm. You know, and then I got sick.
Yeah.
Imani died in 2009, 2011, undiagnosed chronic illness. I'm given 4 months to live.
Yeah.
So I had to address a lot of things. And I remember one of my godmothers came to see me and she looked at me and she said, are you trying to die?
Like you have a choice.
And she got up and walked out of the house.
Oh.
And she called me that night. She said, well, you let me know what you're doing. Like you've lost 65 pounds. You're not eating. Are you trying to die? What's going on? And only you can answer that. And I thought, well, dang. I'm abrasive and cold. And then I thought about it, and I had to ask myself, well, like, do I have the will to live?
Apparently you did.
Do I have the, yeah. But it comes back to, I think, knowing where your love base is. Mm. And I think so many of us, you know, it's like having the old home phone, mm-hmm. and it doesn't work if you take it two rooms away.
Yeah. If you got to stay from the base. So, first of all, that's old school. I think some people listening to this will not know what the hell you're talking about, because there was this YouTube.
Well, we still got one of those phones.
You still got a home base?
We still have two phones.
You have landlines.
We have landlines that don't work outside. And the only reason we have landlines is my 102-year-old mom lives with us.
That's right.
And she didn't know anything about cell phones.
Right.
And so when the landline rings, it is from my mom, or it's a telemarketer.
Got it.
But yeah.
But that base, if you get too far away from your base, you lose.
So you can't walk outdoors and have a conversation.
You can't. You know what's interesting that you're saying that? Knowing who your base is, mm-hmm. is such a powerful sense of safety and security. So, you know, when I got sick back in June, and you were in Morocco, mm-hmm. And Nia, Mama Nia from Spirit House, texted me and said, Mama Jackie is upset. I don't know if you said to her, what the hell is going on with Omi Sade? But
I sent her a message, and I was like, in Cali, what is going on? Why is she in the hospital?
And then you called me from Morocco,
yeah.
and was like, what is going on? I need to know what's going on with you. Mm-hmm. And it was like, it was a reminder with you. And there were also, you know, there was this constant touching that I was experiencing. Mm-hmm. Some of it was physical touch in the space of people who came to either the hospital or to my home. But there was also touching that happened for people who couldn't reach me, but they were touching. You were touching me. Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me of that scene in Women of Brewster Place when the sister's little boy sticks that fork in that light socket.
Oh yeah.
And she gave up. She tapped out. She was like, the worst thing, you know, it's like the unimaginable.
Right.
Like the unimaginable has happened, and her girlfriend.
That's right.
Because she stopped talking.
Yep.
She stopped eating. Mm-hmm. She stopped washing, and her girlfriend brought her back to life. So when you talk about. Mm-hmm. Home base,
oh, yeah.
or the womb space. She put her in the tub. Remember that?
That's right.
She put her in the tub and she washed her until she started screaming.
That's right. And I've had women do that.
Mm.
I mean, I could sit here and give so many different examples of different times in my life when it wasn't a tragedy of losing Imani, but just some other emotional hurdles where folks literally snatched me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that now we have kind of bought into this, well, you know, it's not really my business. And I keep telling people, if I see Omi crossing the street and there's a big truck coming towards her,
mm-hmm.
and I don't run out to pull her back or scream, Omi, it's a truck.
Mm-hmm.
And then Omi is laying on the ground and I stand there and with pushing my chest out, saying, well, you know, I knew it was a truck.
Mm.
I knew it was a truck.
Mm-hmm.
I could have told her, but it wasn't my place.
Mm.
It wasn't my business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have forgotten where our place is.
Mm-hmm.
And our place is beside each other.
Yeah.
Our place is, you know, I'm grateful that there have been women in my life that have like pulled my coattail and said, oh, sis, you know we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Have you lost your mind?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when I'm pulling younger sisters and saying, why are you letting folk walk up one side of you and down the other?
Right.
Yeah, I am getting in your business.
Yeah.
Because I know where this is going.
Yeah.
Like you are worthy of joy, of goodness,
mm-hmm.
of kindness, of tenderness, of being cherished mm-hmm. and not on some condition.
Yeah.
But I see this over and over where people will say things like, well, yeah, I know she was in the hospital. Why do you tell anybody?
Yeah. So how do you shift that energy? Like, I think that one of the things I'm noticing as I'm getting older is the level of intimacy that I can tap into with other women. I'm also hoping that I can tap into some intimacy with a man at some point. But I also am very clear that I'm not sure where my love is going to come from,
right.
romantic love is going to come from. But I do feel like there's something about a deeper level of intimacy that's possible for you as you get older that feels different. Than
well,
it did
does.
When you were younger. Do you feel like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a maturity. But you ask, you know, like, how do I shift from that? And, you know, I grieve. I allow myself to grieve because I feel this is an injurious moment.
Yeah.
I acknowledge it as an injurious moment. I acknowledge that. I embrace that. And I move through that because I can't live there.
Mm-hmm.
I can't be there. And I allow other folk to be where they need to be.
Mm.
Whatever those, if I can call them shenanigans, whatever those, that's not my business.
Right.
And it's not my business to question it or judge it. I have to just make sure I don't get pulled into it and become depleted by it.
Yeah.
But as I've gotten older, you talk about intimacy. As I've gotten older, my intimacy with all of my tribe has deepened.
Mm-hmm.
My intimacy with my husband, my mm-hmm. who's my joy, my soul. I don't like the word soulmate, but he's my soul.
Why don't you like the word soulmate? What's up with that?
Because I see it used over and mm-hmm. over again,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes.
You think it's used over and over again to the point where it really means nothing?
Sometimes it becomes
mushy, trite,
or when people have used it sometimes, and I have. Asked them about that. I was like, well, tell me more about
right.
how this person is just soulmate. And they were like, well, maybe I don't really know what soul means.
They don't have an answer.
And they're like, well, you know. And I was like, well, I know.
But what do
what
you
does it mean?
Mean
to you?
Right.
So that intimacy, I think, comes again from the ability to be vulnerable, the ability, and to be available.
What do you mean by that? I'm sorry, I'm making a face because I'm thinking both the word vulnerable and available made my heart
because
just
I
like
I remember before I met
up.
My husband, I was single, but I wasn't available. Because I had constructed, I mean, we create our own constructs and boundaries and borders. And sometimes it's very, and I unconsciously, I think, had done it. And Imani, it's really interesting. When Imani met my husband, Abdul Latif, she met him like 2 days after I met him.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember she said, Mom, can I see you in your bedroom for a minute? And I was like, yeah. And we go to the bedroom, and she locks the door, pushes me on my bed, jumps on top of me, straddles me, and gets in my face. And she goes, Mom, he's the one. I'm like, Imani, I just met this guy. Mom, he is the one. Do not figure out how to screw this up. You deserve this. It's him. And, you know, I'm like, Imani, and she's like, Mom, trust me. He is the one.
Wow.
And they had a connection from day one
mm-hmm.
that lasted until she took her last breath with
mm-hmm.
him. And there were conversations they had
mm-hmm.
about transitioning. I even knew that they'd had those conversations.
Yeah.
But that vulnerability of being available, I wanted somebody in my life. But I really hadn't prepared to have somebody in my life. And
I don't understand why you always step on my toes when we're having conversations. Like, I don't appreciate you pulling out my pockets in front of people. Continue.
But when I was in Brazil, I remember I went to a spiritualist for a reader.
Uh-huh.
girl, what I did to get that reading. Wow. But she, I asked her, would I ever get married or be in a long-term relationship again? And she laughed in my face. And she told my friend, who translated from Portuguese to English, tell her to don't ask me stupid questions. She knows the answer, but she cleans up that mess.
Oh.
She's like, what? I mean, she was like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Tell her clean up her mess. And she said, and she knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And then a few months later, I was in the grocery store, and an elder who I did not know, I don't know who this woman was, she knew who I was, but she walked up and she said, I have a message for you. I thought she was talking about from person.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yes, ma'am. She said, if you build a nest, if you build your nest, he will come. She said, you don't have a nest yet. Okay. About 3 months after that, a cousin of mine, like a third cousin, woman, a few years older than me, who I really never saw, called my daughter, said, I had a dream last night. Tell your mama she needs to start preparing for a man who's coming into her life.
Mm-hmm.
And that sister died a few weeks later.
Mm.
And Eva was like, why is she calling? And she's mm-hmm. like, okay. So I wasn't available.
Mm.
But I bought the house. I built the nest. I cleaned up my mess. I was available. I was ready for him to fly through the window. And I did, as the universe. When I met him, when he came to my house, and I don't even want to call it a date, but I remember excusing myself from him, going into my bedroom, closing the door, and I was shaking. And I was sweating, like cold sweat. And I said, God, I did not ask you for anybody. Mm-hmm. What is this? Mm-hmm. What am I supposed to do with him? Because mm-hmm. I did not ask you for him.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you met Brother Abdul?
We've been married for 20 years and I'm 66.
Jeez.
So what's that?
46.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know the story. We met on a Wednesday and we got married on a Saturday and we've been together for 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. He's quite magical and so are you.
He is magical, yeah. But we were, and we often talk about how we met. Sometimes we'll say, God, wish we had met each other when we were younger. We'd have all, you know, we're getting old and there's so much you're trying to cram into these last years. And I said, we weren't ready. That's why
mm-hmm.
we would have burned each other out. Mm-hmm. I mean, our lights would have just collided.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been an explosion. I mm-hmm. said, no, we weren't ready for each other.
Yeah.
We hadn't been porked. I mean, you know, we hadn't been in the bride. We hadn't been seasoned. And I said, yeah, we're here.
Now, I was going to ask you a question mm-hmm. around how have you called forth love and joy? And, like, this feels like that's part of that. Like, you bought your home. You poured your love into that home. Mm-hmm. Your home is such a beautiful, mm-hmm. warm space. It mm-hmm. feels like a big, cozy couch that smells like Marrakesh in Morocco. Mm-hmm. It's just so, it's stunning. Mm-hmm. And it's also a place where I feel like you can snuggle up and sleep for hours if you want to.
Well, spaces and environments and landscapes are very metaphorical for me mm-hmm. for how I live my life. I love spaces. I love beautiful spaces. And I'm not talking about expensive spaces. Mm-hmm. I wanted my home that when somebody crossed the threshold to feel like they were home, that they were home, and that they felt very welcome, that they felt tenderness there, that they felt safety there, mm-hmm. that they felt love there. I wanted it to be a sanctuary. And that's because I needed a sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And if I need a sanctuary, want a sanctuary, then I want to share sanctuary.
Yeah.
And that's why we love to entertain, love having people breaking bread, sleeping over. You know, our friend from Morocco friends from Morocco come stay a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We have four people coming from France next mm-hmm. summer. But that's, to me, that's what home is.
Yeah.
Because if you can build, if you, you know, home is very personal and private. There are people I have known for 20, 30 years, and they call me one of their best friends. I've never been in their homes.
Mm.
I've never been invited into their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never asked them why. I'm not the person who drops by unless we have a serious relationship
mm-hmm.
and we have that kind of, you can just pop in. And I've always had that with my true friends. It's like, they know they don't need an invitation.
Sure.
But, you know, home is major.
Yeah.
And it's not about the value of the house. It's the value of the quality of life that's happening.
Yeah. There.
It's the value of what home is.
Yeah.
And it was a home before Abdul came. The energy in my house was purposefully, intentionally, decidedly female. And what terrified me when he crossed the threshold was that the energy, the air in the room changed. And it terrified me. And I knew what it was.
Mm.
There was no male energy. No male energy had mm. inhabited that home. It was mine. And I had to extend the invitation for it to become an ours. Yeah, and I think that's a challenge for a lot of. I mean, I have girlfriends who have fabulous homes and they're single and they're always talking about they wanting to meet people. And then I said, but you know, you meet these guys who you really like and then you complain about how they show up in your house. But he doesn't put the toilet seat down. And I was like, if him putting a toilet seat down is the lead, like, but what else? No, that's the only thing. And he leaves his shoes and socks. I'm like, girl, he can be trained to put the toilet seat down. Like, he can be trained to pick up his shoes. I mean, if that's your only beef, like, stop. This is, like, make it a home. If it's a home, it doesn't matter where he leaves the shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But you're obsessed with this house.
Yeah.
And you've not. I understood when this woman said, build your nest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that joy. It's organic between Abdul and I, and it's not always sexual. I mean, sometimes we're eating breakfast and he just looks at me and cracks up.
Mm.
And I mean, he just looks at me
mm-hmm.
and we both, and we know we share, we know what that crack up is about. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes, you know, he'll look at me and he'll get very emotional. He's like, I can't believe you're doing all you're doing. I can remember when you couldn't lift your head off the pillow, when I had to pick you up and take you to the bathroom, when I had to bathe you, when I had to feed you, chop mm-hmm. up your food in a thousand little. So, you know, that's the power of that vibrancy.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that when you guys are together.
Oh, yeah.
And the care that you have for each other and the way you move with each other. There's so much tenderness and playfulness. You know, sometimes you can see people, couples who've been together for a while, and they don't look like they're enjoying their partner. They look like, well, I'm here with them.
Yeah.
They don't look like they're enjoying that person.
Yeah.
And you and Brother Abdul look like you thoroughly enjoy each other's company.
We do. We do. And we have embraced that this is our time.
Mm-hmm.
That is our time. We have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren that we love dearly. But for as long as we can move through the world and get on a plane and go somewhere. I mean, we were in Morocco this summer, you know, and I fell and I got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And we were real clear, like, and our daughters were having a fit on this side of,
mm-hmm.
of the ocean. You know, it was like, we don't have that many more years to do this kind of gallivanting, but we're going to do it for as long as we can do it.
Right.
And we also do it at home, though.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing, is we can be on vacation at home all the time in a mental space, if
yeah,
you know what I mean.
I do.
We can create that space.
That's actually the next question I want to ask
okay.
you. So, well, there are two more questions I have for you. One is a question around creativity, and then I want to ask a listener letter. So this is a quick question for you, kind of. I remember when you spoke at North Star Church, you said, how do you court your muse?
Mm-hmm.
And that an anorexic muse is a dying muse.
That's right.
And this podcast has been my muse sitting up and whispering in my ear at night around storytelling and the way that I do storytelling. And so I'm wondering, how do you court your muse as someone who's been gifting us with narratives from so many spaces for such a long time?
Well, it's about respectability and having a relationship with your muse. So it's funny you're asking me this question, because in September, I am actually the September speaker for Creative Mornings Asheville, mm-hmm. which is like an international, it's like TED Talks, but mm-hmm. it's called Creative Mornings, and Asheville does it. I'm speaking, the theme is the muse okay. in September. But it's about building, I have relationships with the muse, and it's not the same. My muse is, again, a shapeshifter. Mm-hmm. It's not always a person. It's a smell. It's a piece of music that pulls me in. I have had some very unusual experiences with my muse who actually will show up when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. And Toni Morrison clarified this. I asked her a question many, many years ago in a class I took after her. Mm-hmm. And I asked her afterwards, because I was too timid to ask in the class. Mm-hmm. And I went up to her and I said, I am not bipolar. I'm not schizophrenic. I said, but my characters talk to me. And she said, you know what being in the zone means? She mm-hmm. said, I said, yeah. I said, like athletes. Mm-hmm. Pain. She said, when you're in the zone, your muse will come. I said, no, I said, she actually comes. She's a woman. I can tell you what she looks like, what her hair looks like, what she smells like, mm-hmm. what she's wearing. Mm-hmm. I said, she actually comes to my bedroom, plays on my dresser, and gives me these amazing mm-hmm. things to write. And she said, yeah, you've invited them. So I think you have to know how to invite your muse. Mm-hmm. And that comes again to being vulnerable. Mm-hmm. We are so multifaceted. And we all hear voices on some level. And we have to honor the voices. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of that is genetic deja vu, I know. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is coming from an ancestral spirit place. But a lot of it is my creativity.
Right.
You know, this novel I've been writing for 20 years is about a little slave girl that literally stepped out of, I was at the governor's mansion inside of a room that had a fireplace, and she stepped out of the fireplace and told me her story and looked at me and said, you gotta write this.
Yeah, write my story.
And I said, it's taken me so long to write this because she's a child. She's playful. But I get chapters and she goes away and I get chapters.
Yeah.
I said, so my relationship with my muse is one where I also, because of this novel, I have trained my muse.
Yeah.
Because there have been times when I'm like, no, uh-uh. Can't you see what I'm doing? Can't you see I'm busy? Mm-hmm. I ain't writing no poem right now. Girl, you better go somewhere and sit down.
Mm-hmm. And she doesn't care. She's unrelenting.
Right.
Yeah.
And I've always told people, the muse is a jealous mistress. Uh-huh. She wants you when she wants you when she wants you.
Uh-huh.
So you have to acknowledge, appreciate,
yeah.
celebrate, and listen. And that's why, you know, for my creativity, when people ask me, how do you write? I keep journals. I use my journals like bank accounts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes my muse will bring me one line, but I have to capture it somewhere. I write it down, that one line.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Panama a few years ago, many years ago, 2006, with Renee.
With Renee, yeah.
I took 13 journals. I came back with a manuscript that is now published.
Yeah.
That manuscript was Breath of the Song. I had all of these deposits. What do we do with a bank account? My journals I'm putting in. And then when I have this free time, they're like, okay, I'm going to go write. A lot of those journals start talking to each other.
Yeah.
But when the muse comes, I have to capture what are the containers I build for that creativity. So I'm constantly depositing, even if I can't stop the life I'm doing right then.
Yeah.
Like since I've been the poet laureate, I don't have time to write.
Yeah.
But I have so much writing to do when I finish, because the muse is still whispering in my ear. I'm listening to her.
Yeah.
I'm writing it down.
Thank you. So we're at the end of our interview. We have space again for you to make an offering to the Black Girls Guide to Surviving Menopause. We said that we were going to actually put together a physical guide in 2020 of all these different conversations and offerings. And I would love for you to offer us something that we can tuck into that sweet space.
I think my offering would be, and I think I may have said this before, that we continue to open up our hearts and our homes and our spirits to each other as sisters, that we're very generous and tender with each other, and that we continue to make space for, in terms of, you know, I know the title is menopause, but for me that's metaphoric of just change period, mm-hmm. that we make space, make room for our own changes and our own transitions. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges for everybody, all human life, is we don't deal mm-hmm. with change and evolution very well. Mm-hmm. But also, how do we kind of become the curator of that change? And I think that's more about what this is about. We're all human museums.
Yeah.
And we all need to be the curators of those human museums. And allowing those people that can, you know, one of the metaphors I had for myself when I was grieving was that I was way out in the ocean in a tiny boat, but I could see all my family and friends on shore, like kind of telling me to come back. Mm-hmm. And they were concerned for me. They were worried about me. And I was way out in the ocean by myself. But I knew I was not going to drown. I was not going to tip over because I could see the shore. And everybody was there waiting for me. And I think we have to be the ones waiting for the ones who need us to wait for them. Mm-hmm. We have to be the ones who ask us to help them push the boat out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? That comes back to, what does real tribe really look like? You know, how do we celebrate? And how do we grieve with each other? How do we hold each other up? How do we, like today, say, stop, you're becoming spiritually, emotionally bankrupt. So my offering is that we give more, and we also help our sisters lift stuff up and out. Like, really, I think one of the things that Black women are charged with, and we don't know what to do with it, we're holding so much stuff for so many people, and none of it belongs to us. Mm. So, you know, like with all of these celebrations of sisterhood, I keep wanting to have like a day of deep, of you know, people talk about cleansing, but a serious day of like cleaning out the closets, mm-hmm. real closets sometimes, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. helping people understand they don't have to carry that anymore.
Yeah.
This is not your stuff. Put it on the corner, tell them to come get it, or the trash is coming in 2 days.
Right.
And be done.
Be done with it.
But how we help each other to get to that place.
I appreciate that gift.
Thank you.
I appreciate you and this friendship and sisterhood.
Thank you.
I love you.
And I appreciate you. I appreciate this project. It's going to be so significant and vital for so many of us. And it's needed right now. It's the medicine.
Thank you, Mama Jackie.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this most recent episode of the Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause. We want to stay connected with you. You can follow us on social media. We're on Instagram at the Black Girl's Guide to Menopause. And we're also on Facebook as the Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause. You can listen to us on several different platforms: Anchor, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. Please share with your friends and family, subscribe, and give us reviews. That gives us feedback that's very necessary, and it helps people find us as well. We also want to hear from you, so don't forget about the listener letters. You can send your listener letters to decolonizingthecrone@gmail.com, and in the subject line, put listener letter. We'd love to hear your questions and your thoughts about the podcast, questions that we can share with our guests and the people that we're interviewing. And we would also like to know what you would like to offer to the guide that we're putting together for 2020. So So once again, thank you so much for listening to our podcast, and we look forward to seeing you again soon on the Dark Side of the Moon.